Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boom and Debate Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boom and Debate, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed, it is the Boomer the Babe Show. It is Friday, January 7th, 2011, and we're broadcasting from the Boomer the Babe Enterprises studio in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be getting to our guest in just a minute, but before I do, I want to invite everybody again to go to the Boomer the Babe website at www.boomerandthebabe.com. Sign up for the free online magazine, take a little tour around and see everything else that we're involved in, some of the books we're publishing, and so on and so forth. And I'm Pete Peters. And Deborah Brown is on another call elsewhere, so she's going to be joining us here shortly. I think she does, unless she stays long-winded, as sometimes she does. So we'll figure that one out in a little while. But my guest to start the show and for the entire show is a friend of ours, a friend of the show, Mr. Matt Bunk, who is the managing editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Matt, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show for the new year.
Thanks, Pete. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're certainly always glad to have you. In my little post that I put up about this show, I said that we're starting the new legislative season. I guess that starts Monday. Is that correct?
Yeah, Monday. Everything kicks off. State of the state speech from the governor and the opening day of session. It's going to be kind of wild down here at the Capitol, but. Not a lot of real business is going to get done that first, day or two. It's mostly a pomp and circumstance, but still, nonetheless, it's going to be pretty busy. Lots of folks coming back, after the elections this year and the summer off from the legislature, it's kind of like the first day of school starting back up again here.
Well, it is kind of like going back to school, and we got a freshman class coming in, and I put in the little post that I did on the Blog Talk site. I said that you're going to give us the inside scoop on what we can expect from our representatives. How are they preparing to wow us with their sterling examples of governance, wisdom, and leadership this year? And so why don't you just lay some of your wisdom on us, Matt. What do you think some of the general things are that we can expect to see from this new group and from the group?
Well, this new group, the new group itself is, kind of putting things in a little bit of context. We've got about 90 lawmakers. Well, no, we have exactly 90 lawmakers. And we have, depending on what you call a true freshman, what your criteria is for calling a freshman lawmaker a freshman, we have either between 22 or 31 new I'm getting my numbers all screwed up. We have between 22 and 34 incoming freshman lawmakers this year. Some of them have served before, but about 10 of them are about, I think 10 or 11 have served before, but it was like back in the 80s or back in the 90s for many of them. And so it's sort of like coming back and being freshmen all over again because the issues have changed so much since the last time they served. So after all that confusion, there are about 34 freshmen, counting everybody that's new this year. But about 22 of them are actual true freshmen. So
some of them are kind of like Brett Favre coming back off the scrap heap.
That's it, exactly that. And a couple of them haven't been on the scrap heap very long. Like Eddie Farnsworth and Bob Robson, a couple of guys who have been in leadership or both of them have been in leadership down here at the legislature before. They took a couple of years. The voters made them take a year or two off, and now they're back. So they certainly aren't what you would consider freshmen because they're familiar with the issues and they're, very well respected and they know what's going on down here and are going to maneuver quite well. The other ones though are going to be real green. It's everybody, you think about what, the problems that the state has or the government has and on the street, you sit there and you think of these real simple solutions. But when you get down here and look at the budget and all the figures that are thrown around and all these people talking in your ears, there's liable, a lot of people get confused and there's a lot of actually a lot of confusion in the first few weeks for a lot of these new people, and they're going to be having to deal with major issues like the budget. So right away, almost immediately. So it's going to be quite the learning curve for some of these new people. And that means you're probably going to have a lot of folks. The truth is, a lot of folks are probably going to be voting on things that they don't quite understand during the first month or so. There will be a few real sharp ones that grasp what they're doing and do their research and everything. But from my experience or from watching, you know, previous freshmen enter the legislature, there's just going to be a lot of dazed and confused people walking around for the first couple of weeks.
Well, let's start. I guess we can start this program, the meat of the program, by let's maybe talking about the budget, because I think the budget leads to everything, if I'm not mistaken, just like it does on the federal level. I mean, all these people have come in with grandiose plans nationally, and I'm sure that's the case in Arizona as well. They've come in saying that I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and when the reality hits them between the eyes, they're not going to be able to do much because there's not going to be any money there, is there? We've got a huge deficit, correct?
Absolutely, yes, and that's the thing. I mean, this session is going to be all about where can we cut, where can we save money. It's not going to be about, you know, putting new programs out there or spending extra money somewhere where we weren't already spending it. Those kinds of bills just aren't going to go anywhere this year. Our House Speaker Kirk Adams and our Senate President Russell Pierce have both made it very, very clear where they stand on the budget, and they want to do some serious cutting. Arizona's got a budget deficit of about $825 million just this year, the budget that we're already in. So before the end of the fiscal year, we're going to have to cut or somehow reduce that, or, you know, balance the budget again.
Let me interject, and let me just kind of stop you right there, Matt, because here's something that really just chaps my hide, I guess. We had a governor that was just, sworn in just the other day, correct?
Yes.
And she said that she had a balanced budget, and she has balanced the budget, and she got the preponderance of the people of Arizona to believe that as one of her accomplishments, as well as some others like signing SB, whatever the heck it was, and the whole nine yards. But she never really did balance that budget. Now, did she? I mean, she may be technically, but she had to borrow money to do that, so I don't know how that looks. Did she sell any more government property down there, or what'd she do?
No, I don't really know how much more of the government property there's left to sell after what they auctioned off last year. But yeah, there's you're absolutely right. Jan Brewer has gone around, our governor has been going around saying that she's balanced the budget. And she's been saying this for 2 years now, that she's balanced the budget. When in fact, everybody knows that the budget really isn't balanced. And there's so many different ways of spinning it and looking at it that she chooses the most favorable one, and that's the way she portrays it. She's basing it on the technical, you know, constitutional mandate to balance the budget at the beginning of each fiscal year. So you can put down on paper, here's what we expect in revenue, here's what we expect in this and this and this. On the plus, you know, in terms of the revenue side, we expect all this stuff. You can kind of just project what you want, you know, what you want to see. You know, the state gets most of its money on sales tax revenues and other tax revenues. They just kind of plug in numbers and say, okay, here we go, it's balanced. I mean, there's a lot of actual, you know, economic principle that's being applied to this stuff. They're not just throwing numbers around, but they're using gimmicks. They're using rollovers. They're extending payments that they should be making this year into next year's budget. They're doing a whole bunch of wacky stuff to make it look like it's actually a balanced budget. When it's, in fact, everybody knows that the day after they pass it, we're already going to be out of whack because our projections on revenue are too high, and we know that our spending is just still out of control, you know, in terms of in relation to the amount of money that we're taking in from sales taxes, and everybody knows it down here. The idea that she goes around saying that she's balanced the budget. Okay, yeah, if you want to look at it from some, you know, constitutional technicality, sure, it's balanced enough that you can get away with saying it, but, you know, the day after you pass it, it's never balanced, and it goes further and further out of balance as the year wears on, and so that's where we're at. We're at the end of the fiscal year, or, you know, midway through the fiscal year, and we got $825 million deficit that we need to fix before the end of the fiscal year so that when we get to next fiscal year, we can start with a balanced budget and then deal with that deficit that year.
Well, it's kind of like the term that they seem to be using a lot of right now, kicking the can down the road.
Yes.
They're absolutely kicking the can down the road, and it's also, I liken it also to the fact that when people say that you're starting a business, you need to put a business plan together, and the business purpose of the business plan is so you can go to the financial institutions and get funding for your venture. The reality is the numbers that you put down and the projections you put down for revenue and so on and so forth are to satisfy those people in the financial institutions so they'll grant you the loan, and that's what she's doing. She's just basically, or they are doing, maybe it's not just her, but they, but she's responsible for making the budget, correct? So they're just, she's putting something down on paper, make it look good, to sell it, and then we'll move on from there, and then we'll deal with the fact that I can't make the payments.
You got it. And that's. I'm glad I have you on the other side of this conversation, Pete, because you boil it down exactly, the way, in a very accurate way. That's exactly what's going on. And she's really, it's not just Governor Brewer, although, yeah, she's the figurehead and the leader of the state, and she does have a major role in the budget. But you got also, it's the legislature themselves. These guys pass the budget first, and then the governor signs it. And she can indicate to those folks ahead of time, here's what I want to see in this budget. But largely it's those guys moving something forward and then giving it to her. She can veto certain things, So she has a lot of power over the budget, certainly veto power if she chose to use it. It's also the lawmakers down here, too, that are going to have to bear some of the culpability of not being able to balance this budget over the past 4 years.
And that also goes back. This practice is not new practice. In fairness to the current governor, this is not new practice. Governor Janet Napolitano did the same thing when she came up with some off-the-wall revenue numbers for the budget by including such things. If I remember correctly, we've had the discussion as far as the camera fines on the freeways and stuff like that. She put them into a line item as income or revenue, and, of course, that never happened.
Absolutely, and that's exactly true. The governor's been doing this for a long, long time, and it's not a single party that's doing it. It's Democrats, Republicans, the whole likes of everybody, basically, down here. And what you're saying is true. Governor Janet Napolitano, counted on revenue from that speed camera operation that we had statewide. She counted on $90 million at one point, but it was largely just a guess. Sure, there's some math that they applied and some logic they applied to it, but, they don't really know how many people are going to get tickets and actually pay the tickets. Well, so that's exactly what happened. The next year went by, people just decided not to pay those tickets, as we found out, as you read, as this thing was, as the system was still up, people were just throwing these tickets away and not ever paying them. So the state was starting to, the revenue that they actually got was far, far less than what they had estimated. So there you got a budget deficit, because you were counting on that revenue. That's exactly what Jan Brewer is doing now. She had, in the last year's budget, she had two of the major budget balancing techniques that she had in last year's budget that she, she's claiming that the budget was balanced. Well, it was balanced on the idea that voters would pass two ballot measures that would have saved a ton of state, state budget money. Well, voters didn't pass the measures, and so it foiled her budget plans. I mean, automatically, overnight, her budget was, something like $750 million more in deficit because, voters rejected the two ballot measures that she had counted on paper in the balance, in the budget legislation. She had counted on that money being there when the vote was still months away. So that's the kind of stuff that they do to balance the budget. It's largely a guessing game, and they can play those games, not knowing whether the outcome is really going to satisfy, their projections.
It's all smoke and mirrors, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it's gotten a lot worse in the last 4 years because of the budget problems that we've had. Napolitano played these games when it suited her, but we had, really high revenue levels at that time. So it wasn't done to the extent that it's being done now because of our budget problems. There's gimmicks just all over the place. We roll over something like 3 months in education, our public education system, something like 3 months of the money that goes to fund that is actually not being paid in the year that it's due. It's actually being rolled over into the next year. And we've been doing that for years and years and years. And, it's a lot of money. And, it's actually just a paper game that they're playing, basically, with the budget.
Well, excuse me. excuse me. It seems to me that they just is it safe to say they just don't give a damn? Is anything? Is it all about them being in power? Is that what it's all about? That just they want to have the position, and the rest of it be damned? And do they really sincerely care about the citizenry of the state of Arizona?
They do, and you know I really do think they do give it. You know, they do give a damn. Most of them, anyway. Not saying that there's not selfish interests that are mixed in there as well, but I do think that they believe they're doing the right thing for the state, or are trying to do the right thing for the state. Some of these things they cringe and do. You know, they hold their nose at it and do it. And you know, it's up to voters to decide if they're doing the right thing. You know, if these lawmakers are doing the right thing or not. But they're in a tough position. You know, after all the criticism I just threw out for what they're doing, I have to say at the same time, they're having to make some of the most difficult budget decisions of any time and ever in state history. You know, and we've heard this over and over and over again, but I can't emphasize it enough. This is, they have certain minimums that they have to satisfy for some of these programs. They just have to. Because of the law, because of voter mandates, because of the federal government mandates. So they can only cut so much, and they've cut down to the bare bones. So right now it's, and they've used every gimmick they've got. They've used the stimulus money. This year's going to be a really hard time to balance the budget because they've already used so many of the gimmicks and things like that in the past. And they've already stole state assets, as you mentioned earlier. They sold the House building, the Senate building. And they're leasing those things back at a high at what amounts to a lot of money and interest that we're going to have to pay to basically re-own those buildings later. So there's just a lot of weird stuff going on with the budget, but they don't have a lot of choice either. So there's just it's a difficult predicament for these guys.
So is the budget deficit caused by increased costs of business? For the legislature to do business, is it caused by lessening of revenue overall because of the economic conditions of the country and Arizona in particular, or is it caused by overspending that they now have to pay the piper?
Well, you know, you could make an argument for any of those things, actually, but you know, where I look at it and what I've seen, and certainly that this is a part of the answer, is that the economy. We had a $10 billion our state general fund revenues, which is the big pot of money that all the taxes go into that the legislature decides what to do with it. We were getting in about $10 billion every year. This is sort of a rough number. But when the recession hit...
Excuse me, where was that coming from, Matt?
Taxes like, you know, the sales taxes that you would pay.
Okay, all right.
You know, income tax, state income tax, things like that. So
okay.
It goes into one big coffer, and they split it up with the cities. Some of the money, some of the tax money gets split with local, you know, local governments, you know, municipalities and counties and things. But what the state keeps, that number used to be about $10 billion a year. Now, with the recession, they're getting in about $7 billion. And it may be even less than that, or maybe just more than $7 billion. So you're looking at 33% or almost 30%. I think, actually, to be honest with you, I think the number is actually 31%. That's 31% less money that we have right now compared to what we had about 4 or 5 years ago. So it's largely the economy, in large part. But the state, you know, the economy does these fluctuations. Not quite like we've had, you know, in this last recession, but the economy is supposed to fluctuate. The state is supposed to have some sort of a system in place to make sure that the state budget doesn't, like, bounce around along with the economy. So there's some structural problems with our budget, and the lawmakers are fully aware of that, and I think this year they're going to start dealing with some of those things. So, you know, changing some of the tax structures to attract different kinds of business to the state, things like that. So we'll see what happens. That's a whole other issue that, you know, we could probably talk about for an hour or two, is what they're doing with the jobs, the economy, and tax kind of issues in this upcoming session.
Well, we have this deficit now. What you say it was again?
Right now, this year's deficit's about $825 million, but there's going to be a bigger deficit in the upcoming fiscal year that we're going to have to be dealing with that budget this year as well.
Okay, so our revenue stream is down by, what, 31%, you said?
Something like that, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the exact figure.
So if the revenue stream is down by 31%, that means that we don't have money to pay for services. What services are going to take it?
Well, in the backside. The same ones have been taking it for the last 3-4 years. We got, education's been taking it they've been taking some pretty significant cuts. Public education, higher education. Everybody would like to save. Everybody says they would like to save those budgets. They don't want to cut our schools' funding. But yet it's education that takes up a large chunk of our budget, so when you start looking at cuts and you have to do deep ones, education inevitably gets thrown into the mix of things that get, spending reductions. I don't have the figures in front of me, but we have cut hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars out of our public education system. It's probably higher. I could probably use the word billion, but I can't recall that for sure. But I definitely know it's in the hundreds of millions over the past couple of years, and we're going to look at doing it again, another big round of cuts at education this year. There's just no doubt about it, and lawmakers are all talking about it. I think the bulk of the education cuts may be targeted at higher education, which has the state universities very concerned. And so there's going to be a lot of lobbying down here just to save the amount of money that's already going there or, to stave off some of these larger cuts. Nobody is going to be down here lobbying for more money for schools or universities or anything like that. Not this year, probably not next year. But they're going to be down here trying to save these cuts from being too deep.
All right, let's stay with education just for a minute. And I'm gonna, and I don't know, maybe this is something that you've done in your paper and I missed it. Maybe you haven't done it, I don't know. But in the election cycle that we just passed, when he was running for Secretary of State, the now current Secretary of State, Tom Horn, correct?
Yes.
Attorney General. He was defending his education work in the Department of Education because, of course, that shed light on him and so on and so forth. He always said that no, we're not down that low on the rankings, and we're not this, and we're not that, and so on and so forth. We're not that bad. Well, we could beg to differ with that all we want, but the fact of the matter is, wherever we are right now, we're not going to get any better if all we're doing is cutting education. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you could almost reduce, if you went out and cut 50 different agencies in half, cut their budgets in half, you're still going to have a huge deficit because these agencies are tiny in terms of the amount of money that they take up, the percentage of the overall budget that they actually take up. So you're going to look at education. You're going to look at, and the other big one, which we haven't really talked about yet, which is a whole other big issue, is the Medicare, the state's Medicaid program. I mean, access right now, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, which is basically the state's Medicaid program. Right now, it's at about the federal minimum levels. The lowest amount of spending that the federal government will require or will allow in some areas, and they're going to have to cut a big chunk out of there too. But anyways, I don't mean to divert the conversation to healthcare. We were talking about education, and so yeah, I mean, education probably is I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but there's a pie chart that shows how much the state budget how much of the state budget goes to each individual agency and each individual program. And education has taken up a huge chunk of it. So if you're going to have to cut another 12 more percent off of the budget that you've already got, if the budget's $7 billion or $7.5 billion, and you have to make an $825 million cut, that's 10, 11, 12% right there. That's a big chunk. It's only possible to get down to that level with if you're going to start cutting education or you're going to start cutting the healthcare budget. I don't see either one getting out without further cuts this year.
Well, let's go back to the healthcare thing for just a moment. Governor Brewer has gotten a lot of the only time she's in the press is when it's something negative, and that is always the case. I mean, that's just the way the press works. But she's taken a lot of heat from some of the pundits with regard to these cuts that she's had to make, not allowing these 98 or 98 people to get their organ transplants.
Right.
That's been a big thing, and of course the other side is making hay while the sun shines on that one. So I guess we can just expect more of that, don't you think? Or is there something that can be done? Somebody made the comment, well, what has she done with all the stimulus money? And I don't know, maybe it was you. We were talking the last time you were on the air. With us, you were saying that she put a new roof on the stadium or something. is there money that can be used for that rather than other things?
It's not. I don't believe anymore. The stimulus money ran out. It's done. This year is the last year that we had any, and I'm talking about the fiscal year that began in last July, and that was. What we had, I believe, was used up at that point when we tried to balance the budget last July. Or actually, excuse me, the budget was balanced last year in early. I think it was May. But at that point, we used up what we had. I think the governor may have just a tiny bit of stimulus money left that's at her discretion to spend on different things. We've been looking into that. We can't get a firm answer on how much money is left. It's hard to track that stimulus money, and we're definitely trying. There may be a little bit left, but she's got to spend it by the end of this year, I believe. So, this transplant funding is about, what is it, $1.5 million or something like that to restore that program. It's a tiny amount of money, and she has taken a huge PR hit for this. And, the argument is, geez, just it's so small, just find $1 million. We got to have that $1 million somewhere, $1.5 million somewhere. Well, yeah, we can. We do have $1.5 million somewhere, but this is sort of a principled stand that she's taking, and they knew. All along, there's been healthcare programs that have been getting cut, and people losing their services. That's been happening for two and a half years now. The Democrats have been, at the legislature, have been pulling these folks down and having them testify every time there's a healthcare cut. They've been bringing folks in and having them testify to say, geez, I'm on this program. I'm not going to be on this program if you make this legislation pass. If you make these cuts, I'm going to get cut. This has been happening. This is like a routine. It's a weekly routine down here at the Capitol for the Democrats to hold a press conference with somebody who's lost their health care funding or will lose it. This one, the transplant thing, it just stuck. For some reason, this has been going on for a long time, with the Democrats bringing folks down here. This time it really had an impact. The transplant funding folks are not alone. There's a lot of people like them losing their critical health care coverage all over the place. What made this issue stick? Don't know. But I think the idea of this life-saving, these people could be, their lives could be saved. And I think that, when Republicans and other lawmakers down here were making the choices to cut those health care programs last year, I think they knew. I think that's why everybody says, well, why is it so hard to balance a budget? Well, at the point you're balancing the budget, you're making those decisions. You know what I mean? You know what you're doing is going to affect people all over the place. I think they anticipated this happening. I think Brewer did, and it's a principled stand that they're taking. They don't like it. They said they didn't like it. But there's just no money for this stuff. Is there number one? What they keep saying. So, she is yet to say that we should restore the money for this program. I think she's asked Congress for some money to restore this program. But, as far as, throwing state money at it, I don't know. The public's going to have to keep putting pressure on her. And I think if that happens, then that program will get restored. But I think if this issue dies out, that program's probably just not going to get its funding.
This is an observation. This woman, whether you agree with her or don't agree with her, I really don't much care. She is a PR nightmare, isn't she?
Well, the governor's office, just the people that her handlers, just do not want her out in front of the media anymore. You know, you saw her out quite a bit during S-1070, the big rush of S-1070 last year. She was on every, you know, news channel forever. Every night you turn on the TV, you'd see her. She is everywhere. But, you know, she's had a couple of gaffes, and, you know, the 13-second pause in the debate, the televised debate, you know, that I think really scared some folks. They don't really want her out in public and out in front of the media too much. I think they're going to try to sequester her for the next couple of months and see how it goes before they start putting her out in the open again. She's going to have to do the State of the State, so she's obviously behind, you know, closed doors preparing for that. But, you know, we haven't been able to get an interview with her for a long time. We've been trying really, really hard the last couple of weeks, and they just are kind of locking everybody out. You know, and she's got grammatical problems. Every time she speaks, there's this anticipation that she's going to make some sort of grammatical error. And it's embarrassing stuff, you know. So, I don't know. Yeah, it's something that we all watch. The media's having fun with it. I mean, you know, honestly, the Capitol Press Corps, I'll tell you, when we sit around and talk about things over beers or whatever, it's nonstop, you know, nonstop hilarity. You know, she's good for a lot of jokes among people who watch her speech and things like that. I anticipate, though, that she's going to be ultra prepared for the State of the State. I don't anticipate some of the past problems that she's had. I think her people are going to get her ready for this. It's just too big of a venue to screw up. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of that in the State of the State coming up on Monday. I think she's going
to
be...
Well, this is an inside baseball question. You don't have to answer it. But when you guys are sitting around having beers, who does the best imitation of Jan Brewer?
You know, I don't know.
Like I said, you don't have to answer that.
None of us have really tried. I don't know that anybody's really tried to do the voice or anything like that. But, you know, Howie Fisher, you know, gosh darn it, the guy has been around for 28 years. He's known Jan Brewer for a long time. I think, you know, when we sit around and tell stories about the governor, he's definitely the most fun to listen to. We all kind of, you know, when he starts talking and telling stories, everybody else kind of shuts up. So, yeah.
When E.F. Hutton talks.
Exactly. Everybody listens. Yeah. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other big name, I guess national name down there is Russell Pierce, who's now controlling things in the Senate. Is that correct?
He is the Senate president, yes.
And he's the man of the hour, the man with the power, I guess. So what has he got up his sleeve now?
This is so much fun. You know, first of all, this is what I was going to say at the beginning of the show, there's a lot of anticipation that there's going to be a huge blow up this year, a big kind of power struggle between Russell Pierce, the governor. You know, who knows who else is going to enter the fray? It could be, you know, it depends on if Senator Pierce and House Speaker Kirk Adams, it depends on how they get along, but there could be another big battle between the House and the Senate, even though the Republicans control both chambers. It's just that Senator Pierce, and gosh darn it, I've said it on the radio before, he's just a nice man. Many times when you talk to him, I think he's a genuine guy, but he's just a divisive character. You know what I mean? You're either with him or you're against him, and I think he wants it that way. And when you've got somebody like that leading the Senate or leading a powerful body like that, it's bound to cause a little bit of friction. I think you're going to see some of that between him and the governor. Already Russell Pierce has said some things that make it sound like he feels like the governor may owe him a little bit for getting her reelected. His bill, the SB 1070 bill, the immigration bill, made her very popular last year at a time where she needed that. And Russell Pierce has reminded her that he was the guy that made that happen for her, at least once publicly. So we're going to probably see some big fireworks here. And Russell Pierce, you know, you've all heard about this birthright citizenship legislation that was, you know, introduced this week out in Washington, D.C. We've talked about that before, I think, on the show, Pete. But this is kind of a big deal. It's going to be unveiled in 14 different states. It's basically to try to set up a system where the states can control its own birth, its own citizenship sort of program, if the state so chooses to set one up. And in doing so, they could set higher criteria than the U.S. government in terms of citizenship, and they would require that, you know, at least one of the parents of children born in the United States be a U.S. citizen, in order for that child to be a granted citizenship as well. Right now, you know, illegal immigrants can come across the border, have a child here, and that child is a citizen of the United States. That's been the way that the courts have interpreted the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution for, you know, a long, long time, more than 100 years. And Russell Pearson and lawmakers in 14 different states are trying to overturn that interpretation, and so that there would be a higher criteria to become a U.S. citizen than simply just being born in the United States. So that's going to be very controversial. It's a nationwide issue. Russell Pearce is probably going to spend a lot of time on TV over the next few months, but that's going to add to his problems down here in Arizona, because he has promised some of the lawmakers here that he would back off the immigration legislation for a little while in order to concentrate on the bigger problems that they say that Arizona needs to concentrate, considering we're in the economic we're in the economic recession still. The state needs to act on some of that stuff, create some job promotion type legislation. So Russell Pearce has said he's going to focus on the budget and the economy first, and then deal with immigration. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. If he starts to promote this immigration legislation or starts to move that stuff through the Senate fast before he deals with these other issues, he may have a revolt on his hands. We'll see what happens. Conservative Republicans who back Russell Pearce. And then there's business-friendly Republicans who, aren't necessarily in Russell Pierce's camp, and they may break off if they see Russell Pearce doing things that they don't like him doing right away at the beginning of the session. I think
if he starts getting more national attention, he's going to have to change his demeanor, because he certainly looks like a bully when he's on television talking to these national people.
That's always been Russell Pearce's difficult. That's his biggest challenge, I think, is to holding his composure. And I don't think Russell Pearce is I don't think he's really mad when he looks mad. He just gets himself extremely worked up. Deep down, I think he is mad about this. I think he feels as though this is the immigration problem is hurting the strength of his great country. And, you know, he, in some ways, that spills over and he becomes a little bit angry, I believe. But, you know, he just is a firebrand kind of guy. He's a straight shooter. He'll tell you what he thinks, and gosh darn it, he just kind of gets a little overboard every time he goes on TV. Well, not every time, but a lot of times. And, you know, even talking to me, the guy's, you know, 90% of the time just a sweet character, just very nice and cordial, but he just kind of gets himself riled up every once in a while, and you know, it's happened in front of his colleagues in the legislature. It's happened on national media. It's happened on smaller scale venues. He's going to have to control himself this year if he wants to be really effective.
Well, it's just I don't even know where to take this conversation next. It's just self perpetuating. It's like a snowball going downhill. And it just keeps getting bigger and faster and bigger and faster. And sooner or later, it's going to blow. Maybe the term is a ticking time bomb. It's just sort of tick, 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 tick. And everybody's kind of sitting back watching and going, is it today? Is it today? Oh, no, it's not ripe enough yet. But it's going to blow. It's going to blow. We know it's going to blow. Do you think that's got a good chance of happening?
Well, I do think so. I mean, lobbyists, other capital insiders, the people who operate down here all day long, just like we do, they've been saying. I mean, in background conversations with these folks, they're all taking bets. I bet you there's somewhere out there. There's a pool on when there's going to be the big blow up between Russell Pearce and other people in the Republican caucus. Because it's what everybody's talking about. You know, is it going to be 30 days from now? Is it going to be 60 days from now? How long can they hold it together? You know, and we did a poll online, and this is not scientific by any means. It's just an online poll. Don't take those seriously. But we did a poll online that just asked people, we were kind of having fun, how long do you think it's going to take before there's a big blow up? And one of the questions was, like I just said, 30, 60, 90 days, or never. It's going to be fine. Well, the 30 days, within 30 days, which was the shortest time frame, that just blew away the rest of the answers. The response was like 3-1. Everybody said it was going to happen within the first 30 days. So, I mean, you know, it's not a scientific poll, but it is, you know, the capital insiders around here kind of taking their best guess at it. And I'll tell you, everybody's kind of crossing their fingers or just kind of waiting for the fireworks. So it's going to be wild. It will.
It's going to be fun for guys like you.
It will be, honestly. You know, you sit here and you cringe because it's your state too. You know what I mean? As
yeah,
a newsman,
yeah.
you kind of cringe because you live here. But you know, it leaves you no. You're never lacking headlines.
Well, I bet. So through all of this, we've got the Republican Party in control of the state of Arizona, has been for time immemorial, for crying out loud, I guess, doing whatever they're going to do, put us in the position we're in today because of the things that they've done. Don't want to take credit, or they don't want to have to take credit for the bad things that they have actually had control of. And we've got Democrats in this state too, believe it or not. And what the heck are they doing right now? Just sitting back and keeping score?
Yeah, you know, we keep asking, what are you guys going to do to make yourselves, you know, effective or influential in any way this year? There's so few Democrats in each chamber now that they're almost an afterthought. You know, the bigger question is, are conservative Republicans going to have a sort of infight with the more moderate, business-friendly Republicans? Because the Democrats just don't have any sway. They're just not going to have any. But what we've been asking them is the same question we've been asking them for the last, you know, 3 years. How are you going to be relevant? And their answer is, well, we'll be relevant as much as the Republicans allow us to be. And then at that point, the Republicans say, well, you're not. And then the Democrats just kind of go around, like you said, stomping their feet the rest of the session. So we're probably going to see that happen this year again.
Go pout in the corner.
Yeah, you know, unless they, I mean, I keep hearing this, you know, they're doing this PR thing. You know, they're going around saying, well, you know, here's the problems of the state. We want to fix these problems. Let's focus on these problems. Let's not deal with these other things that the Republicans want to do. But it's not going to have a large impact unless they start doing something else. I don't know what to do. I don't know if I was in their shoes. I don't know what I'd do either. I think there's only like 12 of them in the Senate or something like that. It's pretty pathetic. So they don't have any leverage at all. But
well, there's a young woman down there, and I can't remember her name now, but I think she's from the Northwest Valley, someplace in the Northwest County of Arizona. I'm sorry, Maricopa County. And I'm thinking, I can't remember. Is it Kristen something?
Gosh darn it! Oh, Kristen Sinema.
Yes. She seems to be a pretty active voice anyhow. I mean, she gets on a lot of these pundit shows that are left-leaning. She seems to be a bit of a darling of the press. What's her situation? Does she have a chance to run for anything beyond where she is now?
Sure. I think Kyrsten Sinema, depending on how the redistricting shapes up next year, next year all the congressional and legislative districts will be redrawn. Depending on the kind of districts that shape up, she may have a chance to run for Congress. I think that's what she's gearing up for. She won't say that necessarily, you know, out in public a whole lot, but I think that's her plans. And, you know, she certainly is a darling of the Democratic Party. I'm not sure she is of the media. Certain factions of the media, I think, like talking to her because she is a veteran Democrat. She's an attorney. She's well-spoken. She understands the issues. She's very passionate. She always has been. She makes for a good spokesman for the Democratic Party. And I think that she has filled that role in the last few years. The problem still is, though, that, you know, you can be a good speaker, you can be very charismatic, you can even get a lot of the public to like you, but when you don't have enough, you know, like-minded people around you in the legislature, you're just not very effective. You know, Kyrsten,
you just don't have any juice.
You don't have any juice, and Kyrsten, you know, has juice in the activist level. I think she's got juice, and when it comes to like statewide name recognition, she's got juice among the party for sure. Just not at the legislature. So, you know, when she sponsors bills, she's, you know, like other Democrats down here, the best way that they can get their best chances of getting a bill sponsored, the best way of getting a bill passed is to hand it off and find a friendly Republican to run your bill for you. And that happens. That's a technique that happens a lot down here. If there's a bill that's not a partisan issue, a lot of times Democrats will take it to a Republican and say, hey, listen, here, I've drawn up this bill. It's a really good bill. Take a look at it. Can you sponsor it for me? Because if I do, it's not going anywhere. So, that happens quite a bit. There's a lot of Democratic legislation that ends up being passed by Republicans. That's happened in the last couple of years. So that's, you know, I guess that's part of the question earlier when you asked me what can Democrats do to be effective. Well, they can pick issues that aren't really Democratic issues, and then try to find a friendly Republican to pass that stuff for them. But that's just individual little successes individually. You know, on the major issues facing the state, the Democrats just don't have the sway.
Well, it's I don't know. It doesn't seem as there's going to be much opportunity to change that now, is there really? I mean,
you know, not right
what,
now.
What would have to happen? Let me pose it differently. What would have to happen that if we were to even get closer to having a 50-50 mix, so that both points of view could be represented and discussed? What would have to happen? And I mean, the obvious answer is to elect more Democrats. But how can you do that?
Yeah, I mean, and this redistricting thing, it sort of came up by accident, but maybe that's a good place to talk about this. I mean, this the way that the districts are drawn right now, the criticism of them is that Republicans, there's certainly more Republicans in the state. So you're going to have more Republican districts or more Republican-leaning districts almost by default. But what they have is they have a situation where, like if you go in the East Valley, I mean, it is so conservative and so Republican, those districts, there is no chance a Democrat will ever be competitive in say, District 18, which is Russell Pierce's East Mesa district. There's no Democrats run against Russell Pierce every year, but it's not even close, and everybody knows they're going to lose. Democrat Party doesn't even spend any money on those races. So, you know, and there's the same thing with some of the Tucson-based districts on the Democratic side. There is no way a Republican's going to win in a lot of those districts. Well, I shouldn't even say that, because this year some of those districts, the Republicans either won or got really close. So they're not as much, you know, of a stronghold for Democrats as maybe some of the other districts are for Republicans. But that's the way our districts are drawn right now. And by default, the primary basically is the big election around for most folks in Arizona. If you can get past your you know, opponent of the same party, you're a shoo-in because the district's so weighted so heavily towards your party, for instance. So right now, this redistricting process that the state's going to go through, if they can draw, you know, districts that are more competitive across the state, you're going to probably have a more moderate kind of debate during the elections. You're going to have candidates that are more moderate because they're going to have to play to the middle. They're going to have to be more of a moderate thinker in order to overcome their, you know, opposite party opponent in the general election. But right now, you know, you've got just a conservative Republican can be just very, very, very far to the right, and they don't ever have to play to the middle because their district is so far to the right. So I think that's why you've got the legislature shaped up the way it is right now. How can it change? Well, the redistricting process is probably the biggest change. But like you said, it's not going to lead to 50-50 in the legislature, I don't think. And voters across the state probably are just going to have a change of mindset. We had a big GOP wave here this year, put more Republicans in the legislature than ever, you know, than we've had in a long time. Republicans have a supermajority, which means two-thirds of membership in both the Senate and the House, gives them a lot of power. To flip that, we're going to have an entire decade where the state starts going more and more Democrat. Not just one or two elections, I think. You're probably going to have more like three or four or five elections where Democrats are gaining little by little. Other than that, that's it. I mean, getting more moderate Republicans in the legislature, you know, which is one of the things I kind of touched on in the redistricting discussion. But if these districts forced more moderate candidates out into the legislature, you're going to have people that are more, you know, even though there may be a Republican majority, you're going to have people more responsive to the other side, more listening more closely to the other side. They may not do everything the other side wants, but there's going to be little issues here and there that they can compromise on and reach some consensus. That's the way the legislature in Arizona used to work. Democrats, Republicans, they'd work together. There wasn't always this, completely partisan vote count every time a bill went up. You know, there was Democrats, Republicans that would cross their party lines. I think if we had more moderate Republicans in control who were more open to the Democratic ideas and finding ways of compromising with them, you know, I think the Democrats would retain a lot more control. But, you know, we're a decade away from a Democratic majority, I think, in the legislature. So
the Republicans, though, we've had touched on this in the past. The Republicans have had their own problems amongst their own kind. I mean, it's sort of like they eat their living young. They just chew each other up and spit each other out. They can't come to consensus on a lot of stuff that are supposedly Republican issues. Is that still the case?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, that's the conservative versus moderate kind of factioning of the Republican Party that you have. And you're going to have that, and especially with Russell Pierce. When Russell Pierce came into the Senate presidency, he said, okay, we are a Tea Party Senate. Okay, well, he just named the Senate. He just told everybody what his Senate's, you know, the tone of his Senate's going to sound like. It's going to sound a lot like the Tea Party. Well, okay, that alienates, obviously, Democrats who, you know, don't have any power really anyways, but it also might push a bunch of moderate Republicans off their platform. You know what I mean? I don't think every Republican in the Senate's happy with the idea of this being a Tea Party Senate. So, you know, if Russell Pierce alienates enough moderate Republicans, he's going to have problems in the Senate, even though he's got a huge majority in his caucus to work with. So he's going to have to work hard, and that's the big concern, I think, for Republicans right now is making sure Russell Pierce plays nice with the rest of the Republicans in the Senate. You know, as soon as he starts pushing things that divisive issues that are going to have to separate people, where people, you know, the people of the Republican Party have to start breaking from his agenda, you know, that's going to be the big concern. That's going to cause huge problems.
Some people that I have talked to that are certainly not nearly as astute as you are with regard to what's going on in this state have a feeling that the Democrats lost their last big chance for a while to get a Democratic governor at least when Terry Goddard was defeated. Is that a consensus? Is that the way it shapes up down there?
Absolutely. And not just so much, I mean, yes, Terry Goddard defeat, huge setback for Democrats. The bigger problem, though, that Terry Goddard's campaign set up was that the Democrats, of the five statewide seats in Arizona, the governor, the attorney general, secretary of state, the superintendent of schools, the mine inspector, those positions, all five of them now, Republicans are sitting in each of those positions. Last year, Terry Goddard, as attorney general, was the one Democrat who held a statewide executive level position. So without him there now, without him in that lineup, there is nobody there to fill the gap. I mean, typically the attorney general or secretary of state or you know, one of these executive level positions is sort of a stepping stone to a run for governor and or Congress or something like that. Who did, you know, now the Democrats, when they go into 2012, who do they have to turn to run for governor? Nobody with statewide name recognition. I mean, you turn to people like, you know, goodness sakes. I mean, I'm going to just throw stuff out here because I'm not sure she'd be interested, but there's some discussion about Gabby Giffords, you know, the U.S. rep from District 8 down in Tucson. I think Democrats would be thrilled if she decided to run for governor because she's really the last person who may be able to come out and you know, lead the party here in Arizona. She's popular. You know, Ed Pastor, another Democratic congressman, Raul Grijalva, the other Democratic congressman, there's only three in Arizona. Those two, there is no way that they'd ever win a statewide election. They're just too liberal, too far out there, I think, probably for most Arizonans. So Gabby Giffords, she's the third congressperson. She's probably the best bet for Democrats going into 2012. But they may want to run somebody in. Does she want to run for Senate? Does she want to run for the governor's office? Does she want to stay in the Congress? These are all decisions that she hasn't indicated what she wants to do yet. But she's the last one standing. So, you know, Democrats have no bench. Their bench is empty.
Wow, sort of like the quarterback position for the
Cardinals.
For the Cardinals.
Yeah, it's too close of a comparison, and it actually is a very accurate comparison, and it's a little scary that way for Democrats. But yeah,
unbelievable. Yeah. No one can chuck the ball. Let's kind of wrap this up on a little different note, aside from all the Republican stuff we're talking about. We always have to talk about the Republican stuff because that's all we have to talk about is the Republicans. We talked a little bit now about the outlook for the Democrats, which is bleak at best. Where has Terry Goddard gone? What's he going to do? Do we know?
No, not really. I think Democrats are ready for Terry Goddard to kind of ride off into the sunset or take a find a role that, you know, he can settle into and just sort of ride out his days. I you know, it's not that he's a bad politician. It's not that he is a very good public servant. The guy, you know, has dedicated his life to Phoenix, you know, as Phoenix mayor, to Arizona in general. Excuse me. So there's a lot of great things about Terry Goddard, but his campaigns are typically directionless, and there's just not a lot of excitement. And I think Democrats are ready for Terry to kind of, like I said, settle into something a little less prominent than maybe some of the positions he had now. Certainly he's useful to them. He has not said what he wants to do next. I think he may kind of just lay low for a little while. And then, you know, we'll see if he reemerges somewhere down the road. But I don't see Terry Goddard being a statewide player in Arizona near as much as what he has been maybe in the past.
Well, that's almost a shame, because I think he had something to offer. Agree with him or not, I think he had something to offer. He certainly had a different point of view, and he was a well-spoken point of view. Whether or not, like I say, whether or not you agree with him is another issue. But I've seen him speak on a couple of occasions, and he was always thoughtful.
Yeah, you know, I think he's a better public servant than he is a campaigner. You know, and you have to be both, you know, especially if you want to be sort of the figurehead for the Democratic Party or something, or any of the either of the parties, really. You have to be good at both. And Terry Goddard was probably one of the best public servants of this era, you know, for Arizona. And I think most people would agree with that in many ways. Even his opponents, I think, have a lot of respect for Terry Goddard. But he didn't let Arizonans buy into his vision for the state. He didn't really present a vision for the state. He just sort of kind of stood on the sidelines and said, "Hey, I've done a good job so far. Why don't you make me governor?"
Yeah.
And, you know, it just didn't work. And you need to have more of a, you need to be able to sell yourself to voters.
Yeah.
And he just
right.
wasn't willing to do it.
Well, I want to touch on one more thing. We've only got a few more minutes. I know you've got to get to an editorial meeting down there. I had occasion to listen at a chamber event here recently to Jerry Colangelo, a well-known name in certainly in the Phoenix and also the state of Arizona.
Yeah.
Apparently there's a move afoot somehow, something to do with the Commerce Department. Are you familiar with that at all?
Oh, yes. The Commerce Department is basically a shadow of itself. It's kind of going away right now. They're phasing it out. What they've got is a commerce authority that Jan Brewer has set up. Basically,
and she has asked Jerry Colangelo to run that for her.
Jerry Colangelo, well, not the day-to-day operations, but he is, you know, a board member. He's got a very prominent role with that group. You know, Colangelo and many other very prominent business leaders. I believe Michael Bidwell has some role with the authority as well, the Cardinals owner. So
yeah.
There's, I mean, a lot of really prominent people up there, a lot of Brewer supporters on the board. She basically appointed them, and so it's a quasi-governmental agency. It's going to receive government funds if the legislature approves or authorizes it, and it would receive government funds just like the Commerce Department did. But it's not completely a government agency in all ways, and so there's probably going to be a little bit less scrutiny, but it's going to be, I mean, for instance, do the state's government public records laws apply to the Commerce Authority? You know, do open meeting laws apply? And I think they all do, but these are lots of questions. And, you know, there's checks and balances within government. Setting this Commerce Authority up as sort of a, well, if I could speak frankly, I think the big concern is that this is a group that's been set up with a bunch of Jan Brewer supporters who are going to operate without the oversight of government, but are going to receive government money to run their operation. And what they're going to be doing is a little bit murky. They're going around, and their main mission is economic development. So, you know, it's a lot of murky stuff. You're going around trying to bring businesses into Arizona, make them excited about Arizona. Help them locate when they do decide they want to come to Arizona, those types of things. Distribute certain incentives for businesses that want to come here. It's just one of those agencies that You know, Commerce has always been one of those agencies where the mission is, it's hard to get your mind around exactly what they do day to day, you know. excuse me. And now the Commerce Authority is going to take over those duties. There may not be the same oversight that the Commerce Department was under. So, you know, those are some of the concerns. But the idea is to, you know, let private business owners, like the, you know, the Bidwells and Colangelos of the world, they're the ones who know how the economy works. They're the ones that have the pulse of their own economy. Why not let them have a say and determine what businesses need and what businesses want to thrive here? So that's the plus side. That's why I think it's happening. Rather than letting a bureaucracy decide what private business wants, let's let private business decide what private business wants. It makes a lot of sense. But, you know, the criticism is this lack of oversight. And I guess me being a part of the media, that's my big concern. But certainly there's a lot of logical reasons that they've set this thing up.
Well, and in his talk at that breakfast meeting, Colangelo said that he was approached, and maybe his group is more accurate, but they were approached to head up this organization, and one of the stipulations that they or he or whatever, whoever it was has is they got to get it out of the politics of Arizona, and so that they can operate freely, so they can do the very things that you're talking about as far as trying to get business here and so on and so forth, and trying to do some of the various things that need to be done without the encumbrances of all the political machinations. So I think you're absolutely right on in your assessment of what they're trying to do. I, for one, being somebody that's in business myself, and I don't know Jerry Colangelo very well. I do know of some of his history. I met Jerry Colangelo 35 years ago when I put his son Brian on a newspaper route, for crying out loud. when I was working for the local newspaper, the Arizona Republican Gazette at the time, and his son Brian is now the general manager of the Toronto whatever it is in the NBA. And I reminded him of that when I saw him that morning at the breakfast. He says, "Oh my gosh, yes," and so on and so forth. But I like Jerry Colangelo. I think Jerry Colangelo is a pretty interesting guy. The Jerry Colangelo story is an interesting story. He came to Arizona with $300 in his pocket, and he's built himself and his empire, if you will, into what it is today. So has he stepped on toes? I'm sure he probably has somewhere along the line, but he's got a pretty clean reputation, I do believe.
Yeah, you know, he is. He seems like, I mean, I don't know Jerry Colangelo. I've met him a few times. I've talked to him several times, I guess, out and about. But, you know, and I don't think that there any individual on the board is, I don't think there's a whole lot to criticize about any of them. They're all upstanding business people. They all know their business. They are certainly, you know, the top entrepreneurs in the state, many of them. So, you know, there's a lot of great things about it, and you got the top business minds in the state together. That's what Jan Brewer is trying to do. She's accomplished it. Now the one hurdle now is just getting the legislature to approve the authority for the Commerce Authority. So far, Jan Brewer's just sort of set this thing up on her own unilaterally and said, "Hey, I'm going to issue an executive order. This thing's now created." But the legislature still needs to. Even though this group's meeting and planning and all kinds of stuff, the legislature has yet to approve it. And if it wants to have any authority or any money from the state, the legislature is going to have to approve this Commerce Authority first. So this year, that's going to be a big thing going on right now. And you know, I think you're right. I think one of the things that they're hopeful of is that, you know, this like you said, this bureaucracy was running it before, and nobody really knew. You know, a lot of times the governors, whoever would come in, a Democrat would come take over, typically, or a Republican, whatever, they would typically kind of use Commerce as this political machine, you know. And Brewer's using it. Fife Symington used to do this, where, you know, they use the Commerce Department, goes out, and or the Commerce Authority now, but the Commerce Department used to go out and work to bring in a new business. Maybe like right now, solar is the big thing. You know, Commerce Department would go out and work to bring in a solar company. And if it was a big enough deal, the governor goes out and gets to announce that she's worked to bring this here. Her administration has brought this big company to Arizona. And look, we're fixing the economy. And so that's one of the things that Commerce Department's been used for kind of in the past. And they're good things, and it's usually, you know, positive things for the state, but governors like it because it's been a political tool for them. the commerce in the meantime, then, with changing administrations and things, different priorities, commerce kind of got whipped around a little bit. Its priorities were never the same. You know, in general, yes, bring business to Arizona, but there's many, many little details that that would change depending on which party was in control of the governor's office. And so, you know, having this, I think the Commerce Authority would still have those same kinds of problems, but, you know, that was another big criticism of the bureaucracy that was running this sort of operation before.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting seeing how that all develops. I'm hopeful that I'm going to be able to get Jerry Colangelo on our radio show here in the not too distant future. So we're working on that. So we'll see if we can make that happen. He's an interesting man to talk to. He really is an interesting man to listen to. So it should be a lot of fun if I can manage to pull that off. But anyhow, Matt, I want to thank you. I know you've got a meeting to go to. I want to thank you for joining us again and giving us a preview on what's going on this year. We'll make sure that we have this on a regular basis. You coming on and giving us a report on and a lowdown on the wow factor, as I'm going to call it, I think, from this point forward, is going on in the legislature, because they're going to wow us one way or another. We're going to go, wow.
yeah.
There's going to be a certain amount of that going on all year long, and I hope we can depend on you to give us a straight scoop and keep us well-informed, because I think people need to know. So, Matt, thanks again for being with us. We appreciate it. Look forward to the next time we have you on as a guest, and go run your meeting and get those guys all fired up to go out and dig up more stuff.
Oh, they already are. I already have to put a leash on them. They're so excited, most of them. So.
Okay.
All right,
thanks
a lot.
Again,
I appreciate
it. Take care.
Take care, Pete.
So you've been listening to the Boom of the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio here in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring you good conversation and good guests. And today we brought you information with Matt Bunk, Managing Editor of the Arizona Capital Times. You can listen to the Boom of the Babe Show live on Mondays through Fridays from 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do much more than just host this radio show on Blog Talk. We also publish ebooks, publish a free online magazine. Go to boomerandthebabe.com. That's www.boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer and the Babe Enterprise organization, and be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. We'll see you at the next show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
You've been listening to the Boom and the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as PetePeters47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.